So today we're discussing what is maybe not a popular feel-good Sunday morning topic, but we do need to think about it from a biblical perspective and then understand what it looks like at a local level, how we can be a part of being the change that needs to take place in this subject matter. So today we're discussing the issue of human trafficking. And sometimes we automatically throw that into this idea of like, oh, that's overseas. That's a third world country. But I think it's important that we have, and we're thankful to have guests today, help us understand this is a local issue. How do we understand it? How do we intervene with it? How do we help ourselves, our family, and others about it? So I'm going to welcome all our guests today. We have Detective Williams with us. He's with the Montgomery Sheriff's Department. If you want to come on up, we have Miss Mandy with Dear Dinah, a ministry locally, and she's going to come up. And then we have the ladies who are involved with Mercy and Truth. They're going to come up. And is there anybody I'm missing? Anybody else? If you just want to sit on the platform, you can. No, just kidding. Got a ton of people. It's a good thing, though. So just grab you a seat, and we're going to roll through just a bit of an interview informally, just talking about what's going on here. Everybody's like, find a seat, pick a seat. Bazillion seats. But now I'm in the middle. Ta-da. All right, so we're so thankful to have everybody here with us today. And our goal here is to understand, as we've talked about for years now, every January, the sanctity of life, understand what that looks like, even on a topic that's uncomfortable. As I wrote yesterday in the article, it may feel like this is either to you like a foreign subject, like human trafficking. Like, I didn't grow up hearing anything about that. Or maybe you have this idea of Hollywood, what it looks like. You know, again, everybody thinks of Liam Neeson when they think about like human trafficking and stuff, right? And then for some of you, you may even, because of culture, downplay it and say, oh, what we one person's empowerment is somebody else's, some person's trafficking is another person's empowerment. And that's just a terrible, sick lie that's been propagated by culture right now. So we want to help us understand biblically what it means, but certainly we understand what it looks like locally. And so we'll start here. We have Detective Williams here with us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you ended up in the situation you're in with law enforcement, what got you there, and what you currently do in our community.
Well, good morning. How are you? Can you guys hear me? There we go. All right. I'm Detective Williams, David Williams. I work for the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office. I'm currently assigned to the Miami Valley Human Trafficking Task Force. So, as the pastor said, you know, we think of human trafficking, and there's a common misconception that it's overseas and it's children and, you know, younger adults, which it is, but it's also a huge issue locally in the Dayton area, so much that they created a task force for it. So I've been with the sheriff's office for 8 years. Prior to that, I was a corrections officer and served in the United States military, and then went into this role about 9 months ago. So our primary objective with the task force is we do human trafficking investigations, child exploitation, which is child pornography, other various sex crimes, and then also weapon investigation. So what really led me into this role was I've served my whole entire adult life, and unfortunately there's not a lot of people that investigate human trafficking across the county, so it always drew me because those are the victims that most of the time get overlooked as prostitutes is what people look at them at, but they don't really dig deep into it and see what the root of the issue is. So
maybe even just speak to that for a second. You said not a lot of people do it. When I was a volunteer chaplain in California, we had several detectives assigned to this type of situation, and they all had, if we could say it this way, a short shelf life, right? Speak to that a little bit. Talk about it so we could know how to pray for you and others like you. Speak about the difficulties involved with that.
It is very exhausting, I will say that. And my wife can attest to that. My phone's blown up 24/7 from, you know, victims calling at all hours of the day needing something. Luckily, we work close with Dear Dinah, Mandy, and her staff, and they've been a tremendous help. But it's the constant stuff you're being exposed to, the normal population will never experience in their life. So it is very exhausting. So yeah, prayer for mental health. That's what it'll be. So
I appreciate that. Kind of moving on to the partnering organization here. Mandy, we're so glad you're here today. Tell us a little bit again, your journey. How did you get to where you're at doing what you do? How did Dear Dinah come about? What's it do? All that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I started Dear Dinah about 2 years ago, but a year prior to that is when the Lord broke my heart for human trafficking. I actually didn't know much about it at all. So kind of how you started out, the stigmatism behind it or the myths behind it, that's pretty much what I believed until the Lord opened my eyes and my heart to it, and I could not function the same, and I actually could not sleep. And I had to lean into that brokenness and that pain, just realizing that, like David said, this is a reality here in our city. And so leaning into that meant a lot of prayer and a lot of seeking the Lord and drawing near to him, because I knew if it broke my heart to the extent that it did, oh my goodness, what was it doing to him? And in prayer and in time, just in his word, is when he really led me to, one, look into our city to see what is being done about this, but then also to see what is not being done about this. And then it was kind of a crossroad of, now that you know what is not being done, would you be willing to do it? And the gap, the greatest gap that I saw in our city was this relational piece, right? These people who are willing to go to the girls and who are willing to be a safe space for them with no strings attached, and to simply say, we see you and we love you, and so does your Heavenly Father. And that's really what Dear Dinah came out of. So I was reading about Dinah one morning, and her story just absolutely broke my heart, and she became like this picture of these women who I've been praying for. And so I started this ministry, this nonprofit. We have a space at the Dream Center where they can come. So like you were saying, a lot of times the girls will come in and they're just, I think about one of the girls who was like, I'm not gonna like her, I'm not gonna like this place, you know. And then by the time they leave, it's the walls have come down and they're treated like a soul that they are. And it's a beautiful thing. But to kind of speak into what you were saying too, how hard it is, just so that we all kind of understand, this is a 1% survival rate for these girls. So when you're in this and you're pursuing and you're realizing what Jesus does, and he pursues a victory or a win or however we want to kind of view that, is going to look very different in this space. And it takes a lot of prayer and trust that sometimes a win is just you were able to talk to her and know she's still there somewhere.
So I guess we probably should have started on what human trafficking is. There are several different definitions of human trafficking, but primarily what we deal with is sex or labor trafficking. So labor trafficking would be exploiting one, you know, paying them under, which is primarily what you see with immigrants. However, we typically deal with sexual human trafficking. So a lot of these victims start out as, you know, street level prostitution is what it is. And a drug dealer or a trafficker will get a hold of them and coerce them with drugs. So a lot, they'll let these girls get dope sick. They'll post them on advertisements. That's what we're primarily seeing now, is a lot of the trafficking is being done online. So there are several websites where you can go for, you know, seeking escorts. And typically it's the trafficker that's creating these advertisements, speaking to the Johns on their behalf, coercing them with drugs, and then driving them to and from the date and taking all of their profit. So that's just a general definition of what human trafficking is on what we deal with.
Right. So tell us a little bit more then about Dear Dinah. What is it? What do you do? I know we've obviously the partnership with the Sheriff's Department and the Dream Center. Tell us a little bit, what does that look like at a ministry level? Who participates? How do they participate? What do you guys seek to accomplish?
Yeah, so we have, like I said, we have a physical location where these girls can come. We also do street outreach, so about 3 times a month, and Kaylee's here. Wave your hand, Kaylee. If anybody, if this like strikes the chord, Kaylee is who you want to talk to. But about 3 times a month, we will go out to the areas where we know these girls are being trafficked or are at high vulnerability to be trafficked. And we'll take items with them, we'll pray with them, we will just love on them and point them back to where we are. pursue them. So we'll do our street outreach where we'll actually go to them, but then we have a space where they can come in as well. Being at the Dream Center also means that when there are some of our homeless friends or some of the women from the community who will come into the Dream Center for other services, so they may come in for food or showers or clothing. When they come in, our volunteers can recognize some of those red flags or the signs that they may be trafficked or, again, vulnerable to it. And then they can connect them with us so that we can build relationships with them and a lot of times provide resources too. So we've had a couple girls who have come in and actually said, like, I don't want to go back down there. You know, my trafficker is there, or he knows where I am, and I don't want to go back. And that's like a win, right? Like, okay, let's get you safe right now. And we can do that. We can help get them safe. We can help fly them across the country if we need to a safe house. A lot of times, though, that is the rare case. And typically what it looks like is they want a cup of coffee, and they just want to be able to sit and take a break and rest, and so we'll be that for them too. So it's really not a program or if you want to be in our space, this is what you have to do. It's really just we are truly just here to love you, and we'll be here the next time too. So we have volunteers who will come, they'll be in the space for those times when the girls come in, and then we have volunteers who will go on the street outreach. You never know what to expect, so it's kind of like you can plan out the month or the week or even the day, and then you'll get a phone call, and it's like, hey, can you help come find this girl? Or I'm bringing someone in, or, you know, we heard from this person, and this is a situation, and can you talk to them, or can you just be on standby? So it's kind of like this all the time. So we kind of just have to be available. That's really the biggest thing, just people who are ready and able to be available for the unknown.
Gotcha. What's that partnership look like between the county and with Dear Dinah? Like you said, we just try to be available. Kind of walk us through that dynamic. What does that look like?
So typically when a girl is rescued, we contact Mandy for almost everything. But being a male, most traffickers, not saying that there's not female traffickers, but a vast majority of traffickers are males. So when we interview a girl, we typically like to have Mandy present, just because the response that she's going to give to me usually isn't too positive, because I'm a male and she's been controlled by a male. So we usually let Mandy take the front on that. However, sometimes some of these victims, they've been told what to do by males their entire life, so they respond better to males. Also, just, you know, working with in this environment, you always want to have another person present with you, especially being a male. So I always hit Mandy up. Hey, I got this girl. She's ready to talk. Can you get her a ride here and here? You know, she'll send an Uber. So they help us out tremendously. As she also spoke, hygiene products. A lot of these girls are withheld basic needs, you know, stuff we take for granted, like shampoo. These girls haven't had in forever, or it gets withheld from them because they didn't earn enough money that day. So Mandy's always providing, you know, stuff like that, and we greatly appreciate it because it helps out a lot, and it builds a great rapport with the girl.
And lots of coffee.
And lots of coffee. Yes, lots of coffee.
Lots of coffee.
Can we actually tell a story?
Yeah.
So I'm going to give a little background, because I think this is a kind of a perfect example of what this kind of partnership looks like. So I had one of the guys from the task force, he's a Homeland Security investigator, he called me one day and said, I have nail polish for you. And I was like, that's different, okay? And so he came and he dropped off this box of nail polish, and I realized it was the dip. Do you know what I'm talking about, like the powder? And I thought, why did you drop off dip nail polish? I have no idea what to do with this. But it was very nice. I said, thank you. And I took it and I put it in the back of our space. And then a couple days later, Detective Williams calls and says, we're going to change her name. I have this girl. Her name's Mary. She really, you talk about Mary. Talk about bringing her in.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't really know how to describe her. unpredictable, rude, She can be very rude, but it's a defense, it's a coping mechanism, a defense mechanism. Deep down, she's a good person, but she can come off very, very rude.
Very guarded.
Very guarded. 99% of the girls we deal with are dependent, drug dependent, or alcohol, or both. So their behavior can be very, very unpredictable. But I brought her into Mandy because I'd been trying to find this girl forever. And I finally found her. She agreed to talk. She's a part of a really big case that I'm working right now. So I bring her in, and out of the gate, she's extremely rude. And if anybody has ever met Mandy, you know that she's one of the nicest people in the world. So it was different.
And she said beforehand, "I'm not going to like this girl."
Yeah.
"You can take me in, but I'm not going to like this girl." So he brings her in.
To your face.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he brings her in, and she's like hardcore, you know, just not wanting anything to do with me or the space. And so it's taking a while, and they're doing most of the talking. But at one point, I just say, "So are you from the area?" You know, and she's like, "Yeah." And she kind of starts opening up a little bit and makes the comment how she used to do nails. And so I said, "Hold on a second. You used to do nails? Because I just got this box of dips and I have no idea what to do with it." So I bring it out and set it on this couch, and like slowly she's coming closer, you know? So we're on the couch and you guys have stepped out. So they come back in, and at this point, her and I are both like lounging on this couch, going through this nail polish, and she's showing me how to use it. She's going on, and she stops and looks at him, and she goes, "I don't like her," even though she's like laughing and doing this nail polish. And then she starts dropping hints about Chick-fil-A and this. Anyways, we went, her and I went and had Chick-fil-A sandwich, and I had just had lunch like an hour prior to that. But you never know what the Lord is going to use, first of all, this nail polish, right? But it was kind of this, you just pray for an opening and a door, and you know that what comes into this room may be the hard, like, "I don't want anything to do with you," or what you have to do, you know, do, or what you have to offer, who you are, anything like that. But then there's this moment where, again, they're treated as a soul, which they are. This isn't about human trafficking or what you've done or what. This is just, "Can you explain the nail polish to me? Because I have no idea what this is." And then walls come down and the softness comes out and you're eating a second lunch for the day. But the relationship starts to form.
So to just kind of caveat off what Mandy said when she said that Mary started opening up. Statistically, a domestic violence victim, it takes roughly 5 incidents for them to file a report. A human trafficking victim is 15 to 20. So a lot of these girls, I work off the four interview rule. So your first interview rule with the girl, she's gonna tell you to kick rocks almost every time. Second interview, she might make a couple statements. "Yeah, I've been involved in prostitution in the past." Third interview, she's going to divulge a little bit more information. And then that fourth interview is typically when she's like, "Yeah, he's taking my money. He's giving me dope. He's setting my dates up for me." So these girls, it takes girls and guys, I should say, these victims, it takes a lot of rapport building before you ever even really start working a case. So it could take 6 months just to build a rapport with a girl enough to where she tells you where she's from. I mean, they withhold so much information because they lack trust. So that's a big partnership with Dear Dinah. Is her, Mandy and her staff are awesome about helping us establish that bridge and that trust. And it helps with the case a lot.
Yeah, and a lot of times, especially when they're meeting these girls on the street, literally, you have, seconds to be able to offer something for them outside of what they're going through right in that moment. So I think to have a place where they can go immediately, and then from, you know, when they're with us, like I said, we can connect them with resources and kind of that next step. So that first meeting and those first few seconds and minutes are monumental to even making a decision of, am I gonna continue a conversation with you or see ya, you know?
Help us out, maybe. Sometimes, what always surprised me, apples and oranges for a second here, when I would help at a rescue mission in downtown LA, the clientele, if we could say it that way, weren't who you anticipated. Some were stereotypical, many were not stereotypical. In your line of work and in your ministry, you spoke about immigrants being exploited typically with labor and other ways as well. Where do a lot of these victims come from, right? Like, how do they ever get connected? You know, sometimes people maybe from, not stereotyping too much, maybe from white collar backgrounds see this as, oh, that's this problem for this only person, and this is the only set of circumstances that ever creates somebody to be trafficked or whatever. What do you all see in this? Where do these people come from? How did they end up in this situation?
Yeah, victims come from all walks of life. I mean, I've had girls that are in the game that have came from good homes, parents had great jobs, attended church on Sundays. And then I've had girls come from broken homes. In my experience, the biggest consistency that I see in every victim is drugs. At some point, they get introduced with some type of drug, and it's a downhill spiral from there. And at some point during that, they run into somebody who takes advantage of them.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a lot in the next service because we'll do a full training and dive in. But I think the most important thing to remember when it comes to human trafficking is that traffickers prey on vulnerabilities. So they're going to look for a vulnerability in that person's life, and it could be anything, just that desperation of needing a need fit. And they will find that vulnerability, and then they will pursue, and they'll do whatever they can to fill that need. And then, yes, it's true, a lot of times the drugs are either already present, or they'll build that trust, that relationship, introduce the drugs. Now they're dependent on the drugs, and they continue to come back to meet that need. So it's a really kind of twisted cycle that happens, but you can always peel back the layers and find a severe vulnerability where it started.
And typically, then our victims, their trafficker is also their drug dealer. So, you know, it's not like they can go to another drug dealer to, for those who don't know, if you're an opioid addicted individual, if you don't have that in your system consistently, you get extremely sick, like flu-like symptoms. So a lot of these drug dealers, if these girls aren't doing what they want, they'll let them go dope sick because then they know they're vulnerable to do whatever to get well. So, yeah. And a lot of these girls, you'll ask them about their traffickers, and there's a common misconception that a trafficker's got a girl tied up in a basement and beats her all the time, and which that happens. But some of these traffickers are these girls' best friends, and they've manipulated it enough to, they won't even speak bad about their traffickers because they think so high of them when their judgment is so clouded by the drugs.
Right. So maybe tethering this, we obviously have the ladies here who are helping with Mercy and Truth here in the Dayton area. Talk about maybe some of the correlations you all see. We're hearing about the law enforcement side and the ministry side, maybe at more we'd call the street level. Talk about the tethering that you guys see. Why did you start Mercy and Truth? Who are you trying to minister to? And what parallels or ties do you see between? And whoever wants to.
I do, I guess. No, I do. So as far as how Mercy and Truth started, and we were able to share this with both Detective Williams and Mandy, and you all know, we serve down in Cincy with a group that reaches women that are in exploitative situations in the adult entertainment industry, and had a heart very much to want to serve up in Dayton, and had been praying for that, and God has opened those doors, and we're very thankful for it. And so we are, pursuing that as well up here in Dayton, but we're so excited to meet Mandy, and then she introduced us to Detective Williams. As far as what they're saying, I mean, we wholeheartedly agree. We've seen it. I would say as far as some of the, seeing the vulnerability, even though obviously down in Cincy specifically, you know, going into gentlemen's clubs, you still see the same vulnerabilities. You still see the drug addiction. The only thing I would add, and I know it's like in the training and has come up even a little bit, is one of the main vulnerabilities that we see almost 100% in the women that we know is also abuse and trauma from most of the time from childhood, especially sexual abuse. And it's often by family members or friends of family members. And that You know, I mean, that's an attack against them being an image bearer right there. And that reshapes at a young age their understanding of not only their body, but who has control over it, what they are good for. They're shamed often for it, and they're told that it's their fault. So that, you know, brings layer upon layer. And so that complex trauma, which I know is further into the training and things, can add to that as well. And so we see that relation, those correlations in the women that we speak to, the obstacles to overcome. I mean, addiction alone is difficult when you have a solid support, but when, you know, their trafficker, their, you know, their pimp is their boyfriend and their man, it is incredibly difficult to overcome those boundaries, so, or those restraints.
You find the lines are a little bit more blurred than maybe what, you know, sometimes we think these people in clubs are doing this and people over here are doing that, or is the line a lot closer than we expect?
Not only closer, I would say it's twisted and entwined, and it's one big, you know, it's like Christmas lights you can't unravel. And you just throw, you know, you just decide to buy a new one as far as for your Christmas tree. But I feel like the lines are constantly blurred. And a lot of women that we meet have either done, not just street, but I would say online. I mean, you're right, it has moved to online. My impression is COVID specifically spiked those numbers with it being driven online. But I would say it's intertwined a lot.
Anybody else have anything to add on that side? Why don't you guys speak just for a second so the congregation knows what's going on recently, some of the setbacks or some of the difficulties. Just any time there's progress forward in something spiritually, there's always going to be opposition. So why don't you speak to that, just give an update about what's cooking.
So as a update for us, the business that we had been going in, that we are still pursuing, but have been going into, told us that we couldn't come right now. And that's not abnormal, so I don't want that to discourage anyone. It is not an abnormal setback. In other states that I've been in, I mean, that was a regular occurrence, and you would just keep being persistent and keep praying. So we would ask for your prayers desperately for that. And we'll continue to pursue it. And we believe God is one who opens the door to begin with and gives us favor to continue, so we'll keep asking for that. But we also, even despite with that, we still wanted other opportunities. Like Mandy said, what is being done and what is not being done? We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We were extremely excited to find out about street outreach, and I know some of us have been going through the training, making sure we have a copy of our background check for you so that we can join that. But there are so many opportunities to help with Dear Dinah, and we wanted to partner with local, not only ministries, but also law enforcement. And God, I mean, believe me, we have been praying for this in Dayton before we were even able to transition out of Senseed. So the fact that we met you both on that same day, and then others were able to meet you later, it was a huge answer to prayer. And to have believers on the task force, church, you don't know how amazing that is, and that is such an answer to prayer. So please pray, not only for ministries like Dear Dinah and for anyone who is serving in that, but for our law enforcement, because it is a spiritual warfare. That's what it is. I mean, you are confronting an evil, something that the enemy uses to just try to destroy and tear apart the core of a person, their dignity and their significance being an image bearer. So I got off track, sorry.
You're good. I was just about to give you the tea.
I know.
I'm kidding. Technical Williams, help us a little bit. It's already been mentioned a little bit, but catalysts that you see, because again, I think we have this idea or assumption that, oh, that kid from that environment, and you know, we'd fill in a blank, they had a single parent household, or they came from a trailer park, or their socioeconomic situation, or their ethnicity, and we'd wrongly fill in a wrong blank that may or may not have statistical backing, but perception. What catalyst do you see that propel someone to the trafficker or the being trafficked situation?
Yeah, so as I previously mentioned, drugs is a big one, the coercion through narcotics. But as far as I also said, we do the child exploitation cases as well. So there are unfortunately children who are being trafficked by their own parents. However, in today's day, everything has shifted to technology. So you have all these chat rooms, and I mean, it's like once a week a new one pops up that we don't know about, and now we're having to monitor this one. And a lot of traffickers will go on these chat rooms and befriend a child that they know lives close. And it will transpire into child pornography, and then at one point they'll meet up, and that's how they get into the trafficking. Usually between the ages of 10 to 16 is usually what we see. But
I would say that again.
10 to 16.
There it is.
Yeah. Yep.
Help parents in the room, perhaps myself included, I've got six daughters, help parents realize just how serious what you just said is. Like, you know, we often have these little computers walking around with us, even young people, and there's not a lot of oversight. Or, and again, we're not natives in the land. Young people are natives in the land of technology. What would you say to parents when you talk about that? You just said 10 to 16. I think sometimes we think, yeah, that 18-year-old was at risk. But you just said it, right? 10 to 16, through online communication. What would you tell parents about either being thoughtful, monitoring, how to help, how to train? What would you say to parents?
Don't let your kids have a cell phone or any social media.
Yes. Yes.
Why don't you just drop that again? Yeah. Why don't you just do that? Yeah.
As I said, it seems like daily there's a new chat room, there's a new communication app these kids are using, and it's
to video games, social media. Games.
There it is.
Video games. I'll tell you now, yeah. the biggest one we have issues with is Roblox. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what half these games are, but I mean, there's a communication platform on every single social media that you can get your hands on, and it's. In my opinion, I have a young daughter, and she will never have a cell phone.
She'll be 47.
Yeah.
Still finding a rotary somewhere.
Yeah. But if you are a parent who allows your child to have social media, have a close eye on it. People can create fake accounts and hack into your stuff from, you know, Saudi Arabia. I mean, there's just so many threats. When it comes to social media, I would just keep a very, very close eye on it. I would have every parental restriction you have the talk with your kids that, you know, if somebody messages you that you don't know, or even if their username's displayed with somebody that you do know, but, you know, they're not your friend, or do your background check, because there's a lot of predators out there.
Well, even like you said, predators are at large and afar, but they're also close to home, you know, and being in the foster care system, they talk about how much of the abuse is done by what is like 8 and 10 is by somebody you know or somebody in your circle of influence. And so I think what you're really advocating here is like parents should be training their kids, not, you know, not huddling up and biting our nails in fear, but this is the kind of world we live in. You need to be willing and able to communicate about what's going on. Did one of your friends say something? Did their mom or dad, did their adult sister or brother, did your uncle or auntie, not out of this fear and looking over your shoulder all the time, but out of there should be clear communication, then being thoughtful about the avenues. Like you just said, if name some of the games that you guys see associated. You said Roblox, and Roblox, I'm old. Roblox, I think, is designed for what, like 12 and under?
Yes.
There, so yes. And that's one of your main...
That is our... Probably our biggest one that we have most of our child exploitation cases through.
Minecraft. So, what's the other one?
Us old folks almost be like Halo, but we're really old.
Fortnite. So.
Fortnite, as I say, some of the young folks.
Yeah, Roblox, I think Fortnite is 2. Minecraft is 3. And then you have all of your social media.
And a lot of predators meet kids on, you know, Xbox Live, PlayStation Live, where it's just... It starts off as a chat, you know, just a verbal chat over the headphone, and then it turns into, hey, what's your Snapchat username or whatever it is, and it's everywhere, so just keep an eye on it.
Yeah, helping your young folks understand how to handle their curiosity clearly and biblically, but also communicating about what's not healthy, what's unholy, what needs to be communicated to adults, right? And so helping them understand that through these platforms.
And just I don't want to scare anybody, but I just want to let you know the threat is real. If you have someone who is IT savvy and you are talking to them on, you know, Xbox Live or whatever, if they can get your IP address, they can hack into your Wi-Fi router, they can get all the information off your phone. If you've got an iPhone, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but you can go to significant locations and it'll tell you every location you've been to in the past 60 days, what time you got there, what time you left. I mean, it's just stuff to
playing into that. If every young folk has a cell phone and their parents or themselves have not taken care of those matters, like you said, if, you're just walking around declaring and displaying.
If you would like to learn how to turn off your location permanently, get with me after service and I'll show you how to.
So. Take care of you.
I do want to say though, you know, traffickers, they're cowards, but they're smart. And they will take their time with these kids. And so often if you ask, you know, I've asked my nephews before, like, oh, you're playing with a friend. Well, a trafficker is a friend, you know, and it starts out very innocent of just building that relationship slowly. This is the grooming process that we'll talk about. And so to a child, this is a friend that I've been talking to for months. Yeah, I know who they are. So it's important to know that, kind of like you mentioned, traffickers are almost always known by the victim, even if that means that when they first met them, they didn't know them. But by the time the trafficking starts, there's a relationship that has been developed over a period of time. So it's not an overnight thing most of the time. They're gonna take their time to really establish that relationship and trust.
So to just go off that, we also do dark web investigations, which are extremely difficult to do. But just to share with you guys how crazy it is, a couple months ago, I took a dark web investigation class where we actively went on the dark web. We went on child pornography websites. This is how crazy, there is a handbook on how to groom children for child exploitation out there. There's 15 chapters and it's a handbook on how to groom children and women for exploitation. That's what we're dealing with in the world. So the threat is out there and it is high.
Yeah. And I think saying that again, isn't it so much like run and hide, lock yourself in a closet, lock your kids in the closet next to you. Education, understanding, biblical worldview, open communication with those whom you love, being aware, being accountable, helping your young folks be accountable as well, helping them recognize the signs of those that they're in their sphere of influence as well. Because again, this does exist in our world. It's part of the curse of sin, and you see that exploited to the max, obviously. And it's not the only time in human history, sadly. We know in the Old Testament, God put prescriptions and prohibitions in place for the nation of Israel to stop, monitor, and remove this. In the New Testament, those who used to be doing that, Paul said, you stop. This is a change that Jesus makes in your life. He frees you from all that lifestyle, whether you were being exploited, but mostly he speaks to those who Paul does to who were doing the exploitation. You stop that. That's a change grace makes in your life. So it sounds, again, it's a very difficult and frustrating topic to hear about in church, but one that's around us all the time. And as we've already heard, people who are from backgrounds, maybe you would stereotype and think that, but not. So that tells us we have to undo maybe some of what we used to think and think clearly, biblically, but then also culturally as well. Why don't some of you all speak over here about what you see? Because again, I think sometimes people stereotype people who either are into prostitution or trafficking, how they got there, who they are, but then also the adult industry. How did they get there? Oh, they probably got there and we fill in a wrong blank. What has been your all's experience? And how do we change our characterizations or our mischaracterizations?
Okay. How did they get there? Everyone's story is unique, but there are common threads, right? Like I said earlier, our experiences, a lot of it happened and began with childhood abuse. And so if you have that already violated in your life and your understanding of that changes, they grow into teens, right? They have boyfriends, they want to please their boyfriend. Sometimes pimps and controllers and traffickers pose as the boyfriend, right? More of a Romeo pimp, right? And sometimes it's as simple as, you know, babe, we just need 6 months of this and we can get the new car that we want and then you can quit. Or I just need to do this one thing for me and my friend, that's it. All I'm gonna do is take photos. I mean, it can start with like that little bit and often it's relational. I would say that's key. Not that you don't have the gorilla pimps and the ones that are gonna literally beat them into submission with that. It often comes into play. But sometimes you have that. We've heard women that they're like, it gets taken from me anyway, I might as well make money. and that just breaks your heart, right? You have the lie that it's empowering. We run into women like that. But I would say within 6 months, that is no longer their story. They don't feel empowered. They have been raped and assaulted in the places that they work, outside of the places that they work. They often become addicted. So it very much common threads throughout all of the stories. They often have dreams that they want to do. I've met women that they were only going to be in there for so many months so they could afford the next year of college, and that was 5 years ago, and they never made it. And I'm not saying they had to go to college, but their dream disappeared. And not only does it impact you and what they think they can do, but when you think of the drug addiction, the environment, the violent environment that they're in, they're personal skills and interpersonal skills in a job, how they handle trauma because they're going through it so often. You can't just pick someone up and put them in an office job and expect them to be like, all right, I'm better now. You know, the first
it's like
time
pulling somebody out of prison who's been institutionalized, yes. Like, oh, go get a job. A what?
Yes.
Use your phone. A what?
Yes.
Every day to work. It's like you've had them in this structure,
yes,
that's not realistic for so long, and now, oh, rehabilitate yourself. Like, okay.
It takes steps, and it takes relationship. It takes people being willing to walk through on the hard, to help talk them off the ledge, to go to the DMV to get their license reinstated, and not let them jump across the table and tackle the person on the other side. You know, it is those being that friend and that relationship. And honestly, I would say it is the peace that we have within us as believers that sometimes it irritates them because they want you to fight them, right? But other times they're drawn to it, and that's what I've heard often from women is there is a peace and a light in you ladies when you come in, and that's what we want. Like, they know they want it. And so as you are able to demonstrate that, it does soften their hearts, and it takes a long time to build that trust. We often talk about bridges of trust. It is one decision at a time. It's meeting them, whether they stand you up 20 times, you still meet them in the same place. I mean, it took like 6 times making a girl brownies for her birthday to actually get them to her because she was never where she said she'd be, you know. But it's being willing to make them again and to show up and to take them. Of course, that time one of my nieces made them for, but we got them to her and she loved them, so.
Appreciate that. Other ladies, somebody else who has something to say.
I'm sorry.
Go for it.
I have something to say. I don't know if it goes along with this line.
I just wanted
to share with my church family one special thing. A few years ago when we started serving in Cincinnati, I was just convinced I was going to be part of the prayer team and that was going to be it for me. That's all I'm going to do, and that's very important. I'm not saying it's not. But as the Lord was stirring me to become part of the outreach team, the one thing that I really struggled with was fear. I had major fear, and I thought to myself, what in the world do I have in common with these ladies when I minister to them? What are they going to see? You know, what's our commonality? And what the Lord really taught me and grew me and what I wanted to share is every single one of us have this one particular thing in common, and we're all searching for hope. We're born and we're looking for hope, all of us. And I was fortunate enough to be raised in a Christian home with parents. My parents were first generation Christians, but we were surrounded by it. Raised here at church, Christian school. I've heard about the gospel my whole life. You know, at the age of 13, I trusted Christ with my life. And so I knew that, but I thought these women, you know, they don't have that same hope. But I thought, I'm kind of losing my train of thought here. What I was wanting, when I came to trust the Lord and when I accepted him into my life, I realized, that was my point. We all look for it. We're all looking for hope. And we tend to look for it horizontally, right? So for me at 13, what that looked like was a young girl who was very self-absorbed. I was kind of stuck on myself. I was looking for a validation for my peers. I would get that through gossip, whatever it was. So my heart was very clearly, even though maybe I was moral on the outside, my inside was completely just dark. And so when the Lord convicted me of that and I saw my need for him and trusted him, I realized that that horizontal hope shifted to vertical. And I thought, I can share that because these same women, even though perhaps their horizontal hope looks different than mine, I can share that hope. Or like you guys mentioned, show up, listen. Be someone who listens, look for that opportunity to share that hope with them. And so that fear went away as far as realizing we can share that. I talked a lot with Stephanie about that. She encouraged me so much with that. So even though maybe sometimes you guys sit out there and think, what in the world, you know, oh, that's great for them. Don't allow fear to step in your way. Don't allow fear to stop you from serving because the Lord can do great things. And I think it's crucial. We talk about this all the time that we're serving within the church walls, obviously, right? We need people to serve within the church walls, but also outside the church walls. And what can you do? And we're hearing about wonderful ministries all month with the Sanctity of Life Month, including the ones that we're involved in. So I think, honestly, everybody sitting out there can do something. Understandably, we're in different phases of life, and you know, but even committing to be a faithful prayer partner is something we all can do. Or maybe volunteer your time, talents, resources to one of these. You can absolutely do that. And finally, I will stop with this. A few months ago, we watched a documentary, and I'm probably going to butcher the quote, and I'll try not to, but it says something to the effect of, you may choose to look away, but you can never again say you didn't know. And so it's obvious. We are, you know, we're hearing about this all month. So my challenge, whether it's Hope Rising, Dear Dinah, Mercy and Truth, Foster Care, there's so many wonderful things that we're hearing about. It should challenge all of us and compel us. What can I do? Whether that is through prayer, volunteers. So that's my encouragement to my church family. Just don't allow fear to stand in your way.
It's good word,
and
sister.
That's all I have to say.
It's good word.
So we've been serving together, Scarlet Hope, and then Cincy at the Well, and then came locally to Dayton. I will say that probably the most impactful part of serving for me was when we did street outreach with the Lord's Gym in Price Hill. And I will say that that was probably the experience that really opened my heart to the heart of our Father. And I took a quote from Gentle and Lowly from Dane Ortlund that I wanted to share. He writes about Jesus' compassion, saying, "Time and time again, it is the morally disgusting, the socially reviled, the inexcusable and undeserving who do not simply receive Christ's mercy, but to whom Christ most naturally gravitates. He is the friend of sinners." He also writes that Christ does not cringe at reaching out and touching dirty sinners and numb sufferers. Such embrace is precisely what he loves to do. And he goes on to say, "And what did he do when he saw the unclean? What was his first impulse when he came across prostitutes and lepers? He moved toward them. Pity flooded his heart. He spent time with them. He touched them, and he loved them." Our Father is gentle, lowly, full of compassion, meek, humble, accessible, tender, welcome, and willing. Shouldn't we be as well? So that would be my challenge to me and all of us.
That's good. That's good. Give us, as we kind of land the plane, as they say, give us one thing you would say, challenge, exhort, admonish to Christians who are listening here, and they're saying either A, this isn't a problem, or B, how do I help? I mean, just that spectrum. What's one thing? If you said, I could stand up, and it's the last thing I could say to a congregation, this is what I'd say.
Educate yourself. So Manny and I, you know, we talk about it all the time. One of the biggest issues we see as a society is people are uneducated about the topic. So they don't know the signs to look for. They don't know what it looks like. They don't really know what they can do to help if they wanted to help. So there's a ton of resources out there that are always taking volunteers, always taking donations for clothes, hygiene products. So that my biggest challenge would be to educate yourself on what human trafficking is and how you can jump on board and help us combat this issue.
So everybody can make a difference.
Everybody can make a difference.
Awesome. Andy, same question.
Yeah, so I would say, I can honestly say, every single woman who has come into our space at the Dream Center, every need that has come in could be met by the church, solely. And so, you know, in a church congregation, you not only have teachers, doctors, dentists, fill in the blank, but you have people who actually understand true hope and redemption. And, you know, we know what true love looks like. We saw it modeled in Jesus, and we know how to model that because we know him. And so we are the absolute best people to be on the front line of fighting human trafficking. What you guys are doing today is huge. Having these conversations, doing training, really talking about, like, what are we going to do? Because you can know something, but if you don't do anything, it's almost worse, honestly. So having the conversations and then really taking everything that you hear and you learn, because you have to learn, you have to have that education, take it to the Lord and truly spend time asking the Lord, what does this mean for me? And what can I do with what I know now and how you've created me? He will show you every single time because this is his heart and these are his people. So I would say absolutely education, and then understand how you are so beautifully positioned, whether it's making a meal or just showing up or listening or drinking coffee or painting nails or doing your research so that when a phone call comes in, you can make the connection to where they need to go. Any of those things are huge. Jesus is the Savior, right? So we're not asking anyone to save. We're just asking them to show them and point them to the one who can.
That's really good. Any lady over here? Uh-oh.
Thank you very much. I did not have it turned on my end. excuse my voice. My challenge this morning is to our teenagers in the audience. I think we heard some really great information. To our teens in our youth group, to the kids younger than the teens who do not have smartphones and maybe don't even have a phone at all, or maybe you just have a dumb phone and you look around at the world around you and you are envious and you struggle with the fact that you don't have access to Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, like all of your friends at the public school do, take a step back and recognize what your parents are doing to help you. This is not a negative thing. This is not a bad thing. Your parents don't hate you. They don't want you to be the weirdo at school who doesn't have the same apps as everyone else. They want to protect you. And this stuff is extremely real. This past year, actually, a couple of gentlemen that I went to Bible college with were arrested for preying on children. They were pastors. They were teachers at the Christian school. It is all around you. And your parents are doing everything they can to protect you, to guide you, to make sure that you are safe. And when we look at the world and everything that they are doing, we can truly say that they are following, you know, what we would call this definition of insanity, doing the same things over and over again, expecting a different result. This world struggles with depression, anxiety, and they will not. And it's a lot of teenagers, and they will not take phones and social media away from these kids. So I would just challenge you all, maybe in your hearts right now, you're like, I just have a dumb phone. Or, you know, I'm 13 and I don't have a phone at all. Or XYZ, or I'm only allowed to have my phone when I, you know, need to call my parents for the school pickup line. That is awesome. And you should be thanking your parents. That's all I have to say.
Mandy, you sound like an old person over there, because I am sitting here thinking, I miss the days of no phone. Like, young folks are like, I need a phone. And we're all like, I kind of wish we didn't have them at times, right? So, yeah, good word. Here's what I want to encourage. I want to say a huge thank you to you all for coming in and speaking. I know we have some more to come as well. So I want to say thank you, number one. And then number two, also thank you, ladies, for being willing to speak about that.